Welcome to this episode of Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast, with me, Ken McDonald.
And with me, Tim Owen.
Well, in recent weeks, events in Israel and Gaza have provoked very strong reactions across the world. In the United Kingdom in particular, there have been mass demonstrations week after week in London and in other cities, culminating a couple of weeks ago in 300,000 people marching through London on what was loosely described as a pro-Palestinian march. Again, on Saturday, another 100,000. And on Sunday, tens of thousands of people marching in solidarity with British Jews. These marches, the pro-Palestinian marches, so-called, have been controversial. They have obviously garnered very widespread support, but there have also been some episodes during the course of the marches which have caused concerns. Recordings of individuals chanting jihad, very widespread chanting of the contested phrase from the river to the sea, and banners which have been held to be offensive to Jews in particular and broadly, in some cases, anti-Semitic. The former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, in an intervention which eventually cost her job, an article in The Times the day before one of these marches, described them as hate marches and implied that the police should be much more active in policing them and making more arrests where unacceptable or criminal conduct was exhibited. Others have seen these marches as a manifestation of the right to protest, a manifestation of citizens acting in accordance with their Article 10 free expression rights. Tim and I wanted to devote an episode of the podcast to this question, to the issues arising from these protests, to the relevant law, to the question as to whether there should be new laws to deal with them, to the question as to whether they are a proportionate and acceptable response to the tragic and violent and criminal events that we've seen overseas. And to join us, we're very pleased to have Jonathan Hall, King's Counsel. Jonathan was called to the bar in 1994. He joined six KBW College Hill, the very well-regarded criminal regulatory and public law set. And he quickly developed a practice in asset recovery, mutual legal assistance, national security, human rights, confiscation, law enforcement, extradition, inquests, and immigration. Indeed, work wherever criminal law interfaces with public law. In May of 2019, Jonathan was appointed by the then Home Secretary as independent reviewer of terrorism legislation. And I think he was reappointed to that post in 2022 for a further 3 years. He has conducted this role to great acclaim, has produced a number of very well-received reports, and very recently, last week, produced a report on the law and these protests and the question as to whether terrorism law needed to be amended or developed in response to what we've seen on the streets of London and other British cities in recent weeks. He's described in the directories as having an unerring ability to reduce a complex issue to something which can be easily understood using persuasive and compelling arguments, which makes him an ideal podcast guest. He's also described as a really serious, worthy counsel, an experienced advocate who just really totally has the ear of the court. Intimidatingly intelligent, Jonathan. Welcome to Double Jeopardy.
Yes, hi, Jonathan. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, hello.
Jonathan, we normally start with our guests by asking them just briefly to tell us what it was about the law that attracted them. Many of them have said watching Crown Court on days off sick from school. But what was it about the law that first piqued your interest?
Well, my dad was a local solicitor in Sussex, and he did everything. He did, you know, divorce and wills and crime. And he used to carry around a very heavy edition of Raiden and Jackson on divorce. And so when I was little, I used to sort of put that up in my bookshelf and pretend I was a solicitor. And I suppose maybe it was in the blood. So I didn't do law at university, but that's the direction I took after university. I started off by doing sort of rent reviews and chancery. And I had a bit of a Damascene conversion. I got malaria very badly and thought, do you know what? If I'm going to die, I do want to do something which is a bit grittier and more direct.
Yeah.
So I completely changed.
Well, fortunately you didn't die. You're still with us. And you developed this very interesting practice. And Tim has a similar practice at the sort of interface of public law and criminal law, which work in that area has developed significantly, I think, over the last 20, 25, 30 years. I mean, it's become a real thing, hasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, we've had many battles over the years, Jonathan.
Yeah, we'll get on to that.
Yes. I mean, Tim doesn't know this, but he's indirectly responsible because Tim is the author of a very excellent book on prison law. And I remember when I was knocking around the Kent Crown Courts thinking, I wish I could do some of this posh high court work. And lovingly gazing at Livingston and Owen book on prison law. The trajectory I was always aiming at. I mean, it's the sort of the original human rights law, isn't it? It's the state versus the individual.
You've given meaning to my life, Jonathan. Thank you.
Yeah, I like the idea of you lovingly looking at Tim's book. That's perhaps slightly overexpressing it. But Tim, but Jonathan, let's get on to the meat of it, which is your appointment as independent reviewer of terrorism legislation. Just for those members of people in the audience who aren't particularly familiar with that role, although of course most will be, could you just very briefly explain what it is and tell us why you were interested in it?
Yeah, the role was created when terrorism law became permanent. It used to be emergency, it used to be renewed annually, and so debated by Parliament. And once they created a permanent set of laws, they thought it was wise to have someone who was security cleared with some expertise to report to Parliament. So the key function of the reviewer is to write an annual report, but obviously I do quite a lot more than that. And what attracted me to it is I suppose there are limits, aren't there, to being a barrister, where you sort of lack freedom to some extent. You are ultimately dependent on your instructions, whether you fight a case, whether you concede a case. And I really relished the idea of perhaps trying to make a bit of an impact and having a bit of freedom to have my own views.
Yeah, I felt this was certainly a big part of why I was interested in the role of Director of Public Prosecutions, becoming involved in policy, public policy. Actually, when you're moving from private practice as a barrister, it's quite liberating, isn't it? It's a much broader canvas.
Yeah, completely. And you end up having interactions with the media, I think, is a very, very important part of my role. I'm quite a believer in the sort of transparency agenda. People don't understand terrorism and hopefully they have very little to do with it. So I think having good contacts with the media and there's a very expert set of journalists who are involved in security has been also an excellent thing. Again, it's not something you can do as a lawyer where you're always having to go back to your clients and say, are you happy for me to speak? And the invariable answer is of course not. We don't want to risk anything by you saying something to a journalist. So that's been a really sort of fulfilling aspect of my role.
Can you just tell us a bit about how the job actually, how you function and the extent to which you have contact with government, with the security minister, for example, and the security services? I mean, is there any extent to which when you're preparing your report, you consult with them, get their views, or is it very much you, the emphasis on the independent reviewer?
The former. I mean, I spend a huge amount of time speaking to the people whose work I review, and it's mainly counterterrorism police because they're the people who are using the terrorism powers to investigate, CPS, and then Home Office officials. And I've got a very close and deep relationship with them, and I'm unashamed about that. My role is to report on the operation of the legislation, and so I need to see how it actually operates at the coalface. And I spend a lot of time, if I'm working on a recommendation, actually arguing internally with governments. And equally, the government, we see me as a bit of a sounding board as well. And so if there are internal government proposals, they will invariably run them past me to see what I've got to say. Obviously, I've got no veto, but they find that useful. So no, a lot of contact with the authorities.
Well, it's the only way that the job can be done, isn't it? I mean, I had a lot of contact with these people as well when I was DPP, and it's a close relationship and it's a very constructive relationship. Jonathan, I wanted to move on to something a little broader. It seems to me one of the themes that's run through your work as independent reviewer is this idea that, you know, terrorism legislation is very serious business, and it's targeting very serious conduct with huge import, and that it's very necessary not to water down this concept and start to apply the notion of terrorism to wider and wider areas of activity that don't really justify it. In your most recent report, and incidentally, I entirely agree with you about that, in your recent report, you say this: terrorism offences contain some of the most serious prohibitions in the criminal calendar. Suspicion can lead to extended pre-charge powers of arrest, strong investigative powers, and convictions result in long sentences, including heavy post-release monitoring obligations. And then you go on to say this in response to some of the calls that terrorism legislation should be broadened to deal with some of the activity we've seen on these marches. The law of unintended consequences applies to proposed new terrorism legislation as much as to any other legislative proposals, perhaps doubly so, given the width of the definition of terrorism. The terrorism definition applies just as well to the anti-apartheid actions of Nelson Mandela, and I like this example, the revolutionary battles of Scotland's William Wallace, Braveheart, as to the terrorist attacks of the 7th of October 2023. There are plenty of other examples. A general solution of prohibiting all reference to terrorists or terrorist acts at public marches can therefore be rejected at the outset. Now, this is in response to some people, politicians amongst others, saying, well, you know, they're expressing support for terrorism. They're saying this, they're saying that. That's about Hamas. This is about Hamas. And you're saying, look, just hold on a minute. Let's be clear what we're talking about.
Yeah. I mean, the starting point, I think, is just to think a little bit about what calling something terrorism does. I mean, I would look at it in three ways. You've got the effect on the individual, which is obvious. If someone is even alleged to be a terrorist, that can have serious implications. You've got the effect on the public. And I think this is perhaps often not thought about as much as it should be when people say, well, you know, we should have more terrorism. Actually, the public doesn't want to be terrified. The purpose of terrorism legislation is to bear down on those things that stop us going about our lives cheerfully. And if you had thousands of terrorist arrests every day or thousands of terrorism incidents because the approach to terrorism was widened, I think that would have a terrorizing impact. And of course, the third impact is the impact on the authorities. And once you start saying, we've got a wider pool of potential terrorist offences, you start to steer the resources of MI5 and counterterrorism police away from the things which they find particularly pressing. And by the way, they're now beginning to look a lot at state threats as well, towards people who perhaps conventionally one wouldn't think of as terrorism. So that's the starting point. And in terms of trying to work out I had a go. I really did. With good faith, I sat down when I began to write this report and say, how could you change terrorism legislation? Let's imagine that praising terrorism ought to be, you know, itself an offence. And I just found it impossible. You know, if you can run through the examples, you've got the Braveheart example as well. You've got the fact that sometimes you do, in fact, want to praise terrorism organisations. I might want to praise Hamas for releasing the hostages. I might want to praise the PKK for attacking ISIS. And then once you start to think about the implications, you soon realise it's very, very hard indeed.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, the terrorism law or anti-terrorism legislation, if we look back since 9/11, is littered with examples of ill thought through provisions being put on the statute book to no obvious effect. I mean, you begin with the Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Act, the detention of foreign suspected terrorists, which was effectively struck down, extended detention powers, the control order regime, which I was very involved in all of that litigation over many years, and arguably it achieved very little. It only had a tiny number of people were ever subjected to control orders. It diverted the security service resources enormously to monitoring these individuals, and so on and so forth. I mean, I think we can, if we come back to the protest example, presumably the last Home Secretary, Sir Willie Brabham, didn't consult you before making all these complaints about the need for new legislation to deal with protests.
Well, I don't want to go into my meetings with ministers, but I mean, I had close and regular contact with the Home Office on this. And I think one of my purposes of publishing that report that I did as quickly as I did is that I could see that there was about to be some debate. And it was always possible, wasn't it? The government would choose, that's their prerogative, to try and do some legislation. So I thought best to give a heads up to all the parliamentarians and other interested people who might want to have a sort of template of the issues that arise.
So, Jonathan, the report in question was published last week, and it was in response to the protests and some political and media calls for the law to be extended to deal with activity which it was said wasn't caught by the present law. And in particular, Mark Rowley, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, said that he didn't have sufficient powers to deal with demonstrators and he couldn't arrest people for chanting jihad, for example, because jihad means spiritual journey as well as violent struggle. Although I must say, it looked to me as though some of the people chanting jihad outside the Egyptian embassy might not have been talking about spiritual struggle. But you produced a report which is called Report on Terrorism Legislation and Protests. And the very first paragraph, paragraph one, reads, "My overall conclusion is that there is no need to legislate for any amendments to terrorism legislation now, and good reason for caution." Would you just expand on that for our audience?
Yes. There have been lots of marches and lots of marches. And so there have been plenty of opportunities for gaps in the legislation to appear. And actually, it's quite hard to think of some real examples. Now, you mentioned the jihad example. My view was that use of jihad in those circumstances could only refer to violent conduct. And I couldn't understand for myself why the police appeared to take off the table the possibility of carrying out an arrest and investigation, which is what they did. In fact, if you think back to the march that happened only a few days ago, I think that we can see that the police have use much greater clarity and understanding of the existing law. There were far fewer arrests, far fewer incidents. They were much clearer with the public as to what their expectations were. Not that, of course, the police can dictate, but they can at least explain the outlines of the law. And I think things passed off really much better than the first attempt, I think, which vindicates the point that there are no real examples. I had this worry. I mean, I have sat around with officials, as you can imagine, discussing, well, what if so-and-so said this? And we could all think of examples of how you might, in some subtle and clever way, appear to encourage terrorism, which might arguably not fall within the terrorism legislation. But I didn't almost want to give those public examples because no one's used them yet. And I don't want to encourage bad actors to say, well, there you are. Jonathan Hall says this formulation falls outside terrorism legislation. So why don't we go and say it?
Well, just going back to why Sir Mark Rowley may have said that, I mean, just shouting jihad, obviously context is crucial in all of these kind of cases, but I can't see how shouting jihad would be covered by any of the existing terrorism offences. It wouldn't be professing or claiming to belong to a prescribed organisation and so on. It might be covered by Public Order Act and the offensive, abusive, threatening behaviour provision, but that has the requirement of the causing immediate violence. And it's difficult to see how that, simply being shouted in a march, however unpleasant it may be received by certain people. Isn't he right that there's a difficulty in justifying an arrest simply for shouting jihad?
I think that two potential offences would be in play, encouraging terrorism. So, if I deliberately set out, let's imagine, Tim, that I set out to provoke thousands of people to shout jihad on the streets of London, that you can see how if I did that deliberately and I orchestrated a chant of jihad so that it was taken up by very, very many people, you could have a national security situation. And there would be a real risk, wouldn't there, that someone, and we know the sort of the type of person who currently presents a threat to the public, might say, well, now I'm off the hook. Now it's time to act on that call that's clearly being sent out. So I don't agree that it couldn't fall within terrorism legislation. And I think the other offence, that you're completely right, that public order offences tend to look at, and they must look at, immediate harm. The stirring up offence, effectively an offence which has slightly longer tail consequences, I think would also be in play there. Because if people... and you were doing this deliberately.
Sorry, Jonathan, just to be clear, this is the offence of stirring up racial hatred.
Stirring up racial hatred, exactly. Yeah. If people took that as a indication that they should bring about hatred and hostility towards Jews or Israelis, because the offence works for discriminating against people on the basis of nationality, then I think that would also potentially be an offence.
I mean, I agree with you about this. It is, of course, all about context and always is. But particular chants that I'm talking about took place outside the Egyptian embassy and followed rather ranting speeches from quite well-known individuals, calling for more violence, in effect, in Gaza, and for military interventions and so on. So that context was important. I mean, so far as the public order offences are concerned, this is quite interesting because the Public Order Act prohibits the use of threatening, abusive or insulting words or behaviour, or the distribution or display of writing, signs or other visible representations which are threatening, abusive or insulting, when they're used with intent to cause a person to believe that either immediate unlawful violence will take place or is likely to take place. It also prohibits the use of those words and those displays if the intention is to cause a person harassment, alarm or distress. Section 5 prohibits the use of those sorts of words or displays within the hearing or sight of a person likely to be caused harassment, alarm or distress. So that legislation exists, but it requires a person to be directly affected by it, and that's sometimes problematic in the context of a public demonstration. But Section 18, the section that you've just referred to, prohibits the use of words or behaviour or display of written material which is threatening, abusive or insulting, by the display or use of those threatening terms, he intends to stir up racial hatred, or, having regard to all the circumstances, racial hatred is as likely to be stirred up thereby. And that's a much more relevant offence. I'm rather surprised the police haven't been focusing more on that, because that doesn't just depend on someone present on the sidelines of the demonstration. I mean, you could see something on television, on a news report or in a newspaper report, which simply replicates something said in the demonstration which had that effect. So this is quite potentially a broad offence and might apply to some of the material that was apparently anti-Semitic.
Yes, I think you're right. And it's interesting that that's one respect in which the Public Order Act is similar to terrorism. So terrorism legislation, as one of my predecessors very memorably said, defends further up the field. It allows the police to carry out arrests and intervene when people are doing things which aren't actually involving violence, but might lead to violence. And that could be through a speech act defence, it could be through preparation. And the reason why terrorism legislation is controversial is that it therefore catches people who are doing things which aren't inherently criminal, but could lead to crime. In that respect, the stirring up offence is quite similar. It's about people who aren't necessarily calling for immediate violence, but are saying something which could lead to that in the future. I mean, I think you have to say it needs some quite serious controls, that offence, because there are many things that you can say which could lead to hatred, and certainly certain things which are very innocent. There's a good example of a BBC Three documentary about the grooming gangs, which was cited by the man who murdered a worshipper outside Finsbury Park Mosque in 2017. He was a terrorist, but he was inspired by a BBC Three documentary. So I think you have to be quite careful about simply looking at the outcomes. Am I cause distress? Could this give rise to hatred before you bring prosecutions? Because many things that we say can either deliberately or accidentally lead to hostility.
Is there a problem here of the complexity of the law and these parallel streams of legislation, so public order legislation and terrorism legislation, and the extent to which the ordinary copper sort of try to police a demonstration of 300,000 people and you've got only about 1,000 police officers, is supposed to be able to work out, this person's shouting jihad. Well, I'm satisfied that there isn't an imminent threat of violence in a public order sense. It's just a sort of person shouting it. However, I have to consider Section 1 of the Terrorism Act, which is the encouragement offence, and I then have to realise that the same requirement of imminence of violence isn't necessarily there. I mean, it's an incredibly difficult decision for a police officer to make on the ground, isn't it?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, there's a good example of this, which is that there's a... away from the public order matter, there are these people called monitors, and it's like an American fashion. And they go around police stations and they take pictures of the car number plates of police officers. And local police officers come out saying, "What on earth are you doing?" And quite often, the only power they think of is Section 43 of the Terrorism Act. And they carry out these stops and searches on the basis they're suspected to be a terrorist. But they're just funny little old men with recording devices, and they've had to pay out a little bit of money. So I agree, it is very difficult for police. But I think it's a good thing, isn't it, that the Terrorism Act is in a separate box marked Terrorism Act. I would not want to see terrorism powers within the Public Order Act. And generally speaking, the police will take a lot of advice before they start triggering that particular set of investigative measures.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is, as we said, the reason the Public Order Act, or most of it, is not terribly helpful in this situation is it requires the presence of people who are upset, alarmed, distressed, scared, frightened, in fear of violence. And usually these demonstrations are taking up the whole of the road, and all the people on the demonstration want to be there, and those hypothetical people don't exist. Jonathan, can we go to one other example, which I think encapsulates very nicely the problem here, if it is a problem rather than just an aspect of life. You and I spoke at a public event last week, and I raised this, and this is the chant "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Now, there are people who think that chant itself should be unlawful and is genocidal. And the reason they think that is that the context of this chant is that it was an aspect of Hamas's founding charter, and indeed of some Islamist people over the years towards the state of Israel, that Jews would be pushed into the sea. I mean, explicitly, Jews will be pushed. We'll push the Jews into the sea, off the land of Israel, and into the sea. And the that has resonances, doesn't it, of events in Eastern Europe during the Second World War, when Jews were sometimes pushed into marshes and left to drown. And if you perceive that chant in that context, it is genocidal, it is anti-Semitic, it is vile. On the other hand, it's not unlawful to call for a free Palestine. And I've spoken to young people who have been on those marches and asked them about this chant, and they've said to me, we're not talking about pushing Jews into the sea at all. We're talking about a single free country containing Jews and Palestinians living together peacefully. So to prosecute someone for chanting "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free" is an impossible task, unless there's other context there to indicate that it's intended in the sense that Hamas intended, as a genocidal chant. But with absent that contextualizing, supporting evidence, there's nothing that the law can do to intervene when someone chants "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." I mean, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I agree, and nor should it. It's not a tradition in this country to make it an offence to use certain formulae of words, and I hope it never is. If it was, people would soon find other ways of saying it. They'd chant, you know, "From the river to the marsh or something. There's also a huge amount of ignorance. I mean, we know that people saying this phrase sometimes don't know what river they're referring to. I'd be very worried about people being criminalised for serious offences on the basis of ignorance. I think the remedy here is just more debate and more challenge. When people use that phrase, they need to be challenged and asked what they mean by it. I don't think the criminal law can be used.
Yeah. I mean, of course, part of Miss Braverman's contribution to public life in the context of this debate was she was basically directing the police to consider interpreting those words as, quote, "an expression of a violent desire to see Israel erased from the world." And so that's the Home Secretary purporting to direct police chiefs about how to exercise their discretion to arrest. I mean, that's just not acceptable, is it?
But of course, that is precisely how some people mean it, and that's why it's controversial.
I mean, the point I'm making is a politician effectively intervening in what is an extremely complex, difficult, context-laden issue, isn't it? I mean, you can't have an absolute rule like that.
True. But I'm a big believer in debate and getting these things out on the table. I read the Suella Braverman letter. I didn't think that itself was objectionable. I think she was just pointing out the provisions that could apply. I mean, I myself have made points publicly and said I think that the police could consider this, could consider that. What I know is the police are robust enough to ignore directions from anyone.
But that's true.
I think it's a good thing to have this debate. And I think the police have responded to it, actually. I think, as I mentioned last week, I think you saw a lot greater clarity because these things are now being properly debated in public.
What, Jonathan, what about the question of public confidence? Because it seems to me there's no doubt at all that these marches, these protests, and some of the things being chanted on them, some of the banners, have had a a huge impact on the British Jewish community, upon their feeling of security, upon their sense that they are safe in the United Kingdom. Now, I think this is something which governments obviously have to be concerned about and should be concerned about as their primary duty. It's also something the criminal law should be concerned about. I mean, what do you think can legitimately be done, bar developing and amending terrorism law, which I don't think would help, to develop the security and safety of Jewish people in this country?
Well, I think I would distinguish between safety in its contested sense and safety in its real sense. So safety in its contested sense is the one that one's heard in the transgender debates, for example, where people say if you use the wrong pronouns or you question whether or not an adult, all that stuff, you make me feel unsafe. And I don't think it can be any part of the criminal law to protect safety in that sense, because the consequences would be to make certain things unsayable. But there is safety in a proper sense, which is violence, genocide, at its worst expression, the Holocaust. And there, I think the criminal law, and in particular stirring up racial hatred, does play a role. So, I mean, I'm pleased that the police clearly are using that offence more. They are prepared to intervene and arrest more. And I think British Jews, their real fear, I suspect, is that a great mob of people will be inspired to one day use violence against them, and that these marches could incite people towards that. So I think that's why you use that special offence of stirring up racial hatred. You have to use it wisely. But that seems to me the real solution to the safety point that you use. I don't think there's an easy solution to that general feeling of discomfort. I mean, it's completely right that Jewish people feel they don't want to go to central London during those marches. I suspect they are less in danger than they may fear, but that doesn't take away their subjective sense of fear. But I don't think the criminal law can protect that subjective sense of unease without biting too hard on rights of protest and speech.
Well, people are going to feel very strongly about what's happening in Gaza one way or another, and people have the right to express their views, people have the right to demonstrate, people have the right to chant, people have the right to hold up banners. And I entirely agree with you that I think the offence which really bites here when it's being committed is the Section 18 stirring up offence. Stirring up itself is quite an interesting term, isn't it? Because it gives a prosecutor quite a bit of leeway, doesn't it? I mean, what is... I think we discussed this at the event we were speaking at last week, Jonathan. I'm not sure anyone's ever really defined what stirring up means. No. I mean, it sounds like a bowl of porridge.
It does. It's a wonderfully evocative phrase. Yeah. But I've looked at Blackstones and Archbold. No one's dared to try and define it. I mean, it can only be prosecuted with the consent of the Attorney General.
Yeah, it must have been deliberate. It must have been deliberate, the use of a phrase like that, to give a bit of leeway. But as you say, it needs the consent of the Attorney General. There's no reason to believe the Attorney General would withhold her consent in appropriate cases.
Terrorism legislation is full of these kind of stretching of language. You quote in your excellent paper that Ken's already referred to, the professing to belong offence that was enacted in the Terrorism Act 2000. I was involved in the Attorney General's reference case that went to the House of Lords in relation to a young man who's arrived in the UK in April 2001. And after 9/11, he was living in a hostel for asylum seekers. And he was going around sort of praising the attacks and saying, "I am Hamas," and so on. So he ended up being prosecuted under the professing offence of professing to belong to a prescribed organisation. And Lord Bingham commented in the House of Lords that it was a very strange concept to create a criminal offence of professing to belong to something. And it's a good example, isn't it, of how legislators can often create real problems in the legitimate sort of confines of the criminal law and extend it into areas that we wouldn't normally dream of criminalising.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think that, I mean, my experience, all of these offences are created for good reason. I haven't seen anyone really suggesting a new terrorism offence for political reasons. I think there's a contrast to maybe with Australia, for example, where terrorism legislation is often used as a sort of political tool to try and beat the opposition and propose heavier and heavier terrorism interventions to try and dare the opposition to oppose. That doesn't happen here, which is a good thing. But I mean, you're absolutely right. There are certain I mean, there was something created in 2019 called the Designated Area Offence, which was intended to make it a crime to go to certain parts of the world. And it was designed to deal with places like Raqqa in Iraq and Syria, where people were going to join Islamic State. It's never been used. And it's one of those things that when you actually think about it, it's very hard for the Secretary of State to sit down and say, we, the UK, are going to designate a part of the world as a terrorism hotspot without, frankly, insulting the rulers of that country and making it very hard to cooperate with them. But, you know, no one really sort of thinks these things. It's hard to think these things through. Let's just say, but it's hard to work out all the practical implications when they create these new offences.
I mean, do you think we've got enough terrorism legislation, Jonathan? I say that because it has been a pattern in recent years that when an outrage occurs, the politicians scrabble around for something, in inverted commas, to do about it. And, you know, something must be done. And what must be done is legislation, more legislation. And indeed, we've seen that around these demonstrations, haven't we? That some politicians have been calling for more law. And your paper very clearly sets out, and I should say, if anyone wants to read it, they can find it online. Your paper very clearly sets out why terrorism legislation shouldn't be developed to meet this situation. I mean, do you think we've got enough?
And just before you answer that, Jonathan, I mean, it's also in the public order field. Of course, it's only in May of this year that the Public Order Act 2023 came on the statute book, which was really focusing at protests by Extinction Rebellion, Just Stop Oil, Insulate Britain, and created a whole new raft of offences in that area.
I'm not a believer that terrorism legislation needs to stand still, or that my role is to be a sort of guardian and to say no when people are proposing developments. I mean, there are some areas, I think, where developments could be necessary. For example, managing released terrorist defenders after Fishmongers Hall, there were significant gaps in the authorities' ability to share information, to control movements, etc. So I think sometimes it's necessary. And I would also make the point that terrorists are quite creative and inventive. Many are STEM subject people with technological understanding. And inevitably, because technology marches on, and AI is something I'm looking at quite a lot at the moment, I think we are going to have to start looking at new provisions to deal with the rise of terrorist chatbots and the like. And that's just inevitable, because when society changes, particularly technologically, terrorism will change as well. So I don't close the door to further ones. I think the key thing, though, is to make sure that... Well, there are two key things. One is to make sure that the current law is being used effectively, because, frankly, it takes quite a lot of time for legislation to get on the statute books, and there is this terrible risk of unintended consequences. And secondly, that the public understand what law is actually present, so that you don't have a sort of bidding war where politicians might be tempted to say, look, what we need is more law rather than just better use of the existing law.
Well, I think the role of the independent reviewer is crucial in bringing that sort of public understanding. And as I said at the beginning, I think you've fulfilled that role with great distinction, Jonathan. So thank you very much indeed for joining us today.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thanks a lot, Jonathan. Thank you. You've been listening to Double Jeopardy, the Law and Politics podcast with Ken MacDonald and with me, Tim Owen. If you've enjoyed this episode, have a look at our back catalogue. We've got a wide range of guests ranging from Professor Kathleen Stock, Baroness Brenda Hale, Dominic Grieve, Robert Buckland, and a whole host of others. So have a look at that. If you've enjoyed it and want to give us a good review, please do so and tell your friends. And we'll see you soon. Our editor is Billy Lawrence, and our social media advisor is Jess Jones.